Morning, counsel.
Morning.
Mr. Is it Bowerman?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you. And to start off, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you, Judge Restrepo, and may it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Alex Bowerman. I'm pro bono counsel for petitioner Kay-Ann Darby, who is a cooperating government witness and a mother of 4 U.S. citizens.
May I just ask, wait a second. Let me just ask whether we are taking any precautions here about the release of this. This is currently on live stream. Are there any concerns about proceeding on live stream and with a public transcript? I just raised that when you mentioned cooperating witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the question. The way I planned to present my argument was to refer to the people in that are mentioned in the briefs, just as people in Jamaica, not to use any of their names. But Ms. Darby's motion to seal otherwise in this case has been denied. So mm-hmm. generally about her claims for relief, we're fine proceeding.
Thanks. I'll try to remember not to use the names of the other people involved as well, but we know who you're referring to.
Right. Yes. Thank you, Your Honors. So, Your Honors, Ms. Darby advanced 2 claims before the BIA in a motion to reopen, a claim for protection under the Convention Against Torture and a request for a so-called sua sponte reopening based upon her new family-based visa eligibility. Today, Your Honors, I'll address the sua sponte reopening claim first, including the court's questions about jurisdiction on that claim, and I'll address the Convention Against Torture claim second. Starting with the jurisdiction on the sua sponte reopening claim, there does not appear to be a dispute about the basic principles. The court has jurisdiction to review an error of law or a constitutional violation. Ms. Darby is challenging 2 aspects of the denial of her request to reopen based on her family-based visa eligibility. First, Your Honors, is the BIA's assessment of Ms. Darby's eligibility for adjustment of status. That's a pure question of law, as this court has explained in decisions like Carter, Pino, and Hokeu, said at page 43 of our opening brief. There's no real question about the court's jurisdiction to address that issue under the standards set forth in Pulumi, and the BIA did make a legal error in that assessment. I can take just a minute to explain why. The BIA said that Ms. Darby was, quote, potentially eligible for adjustment of status based on a visa application filed by her son. That's at page 9 of the appendix, and that's incorrect.
They said it twice in one of their concluding paragraphs, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and it's the concluding paragraph that I think really highlights the error here.
So is that a material misstatement of the law?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And so to explain just for a moment the difference between being potentially eligible and actually eligible, Ms. Darby wasn't potentially eligible because it's not that she was going to become eligible in the future if something else happened.
No, wait a second, though. Let me dispute you on that. She doesn't have the 212 waiver yet. She has to get the waiver. The waiver is not automatic. So why is it not that she is potentially eligible at least until the waiver comes through?
Because, Your Honor, it's a function of timing. Both applications are submitted at the same time.
So then she's potentially eligible until the other one comes through.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we disagree that she's eligible to apply. It's not that she's entitled. It's not that she will receive it. But at this point, there's nothing else that would need to happen except for the case to be reopened in order for her to submit her application.
Oh, but there's a two-step process here. I mean, if the government denies the 212, she is not eligible in any form, correct?
Your Honor, I would just dispute the characterization of this as a two-step process. It's really a two-element process, but it's one-
Two-element process. Okay, call it what you want to call it. She has to get past that element. If she doesn't, she doesn't get relief. So at most, this is an issue of nomenclature as to whether she's potentially eligible until the waiver comes through. What you would write before you get to that first hurdle. Why is it, I mean, you're disputing whether it's two-step or two-element, but let's say yours is a slightly better way of characterizing it. Why is this not just a matter of terminology here?
Because, Your Honor, as I would work practically, both applications are ready to be filed, to be presented to the same decision maker who will decide whether an exercise of discretion in her favor is appropriate. And Your Honor, just to add another data point into this category here about how, actually two more data points into how eligible or potentially eligible is used. In the Oksana Shulgin case we cite in our opening brief at page 45, that's where the description is correct. The BIA recognized that the petitioner there had established prima facie eligibility for adjustment of status because she had married a citizen, submitted her applications.
Is there any statute or reg that defines eligible or potentially eligible? I'm not aware of one.
It's not defined in the statute, Your Honor, but in the U.S. policy manual.
Is there any governing precedent from this circuit that defines it as a term of art?
The way it's used in Hashmi, Your Honor, I think is instructive here. That's not a reopening case, but that was describing somebody who actually had not even had an I-130 approved yet as being eligible, because at that point, everything that they needed to submit was pending.
We used it that way in one prior case, but we haven't turned it into a term of art or codified test in anything you can point to, have we?
This court hasn't, Your Honor, but I think both the Oksana Shulgin decision and the USCIS policy manual does. In describing who is eligible for adjustment of status, the USCIS policy manual.
Okay, could you give me the citation to the page or section?
Sure, the USCIS policy manual at volume 7, part B, chapter 2. In describing the list of eligibility requirements for who is eligible to adjust status, it says that the applicant must be admissible to the U.S. or for lawful permanent residence, or eligible for a waiver of inadmissibility or other form of relief. And that's exactly what Ms. Darby was here. She's eligible to apply for adjustment of status because she's eligible for a 212H waiver. And if the BIA had gotten her eligibility right, like it did in the Oksana Shulgin decision, where it described the petitioner there as eligible to apply for adjustment of status, it might have come out the other way.
Could you give me the citation for Oksana Shulgin in the spelling?
Yes, Your Honor. It's at page 45 of our opening brief.
Okay.
It's spelled O-K-S-A-N-A. Shulgin is then S-H-U-L-I-N. And so, Your Honor, one last comment on this part of the sua sponte claim. It's worth noting the only reason Ms. Darby brought this claim in the posture that she did, it's because the government kept her in the United States. It postponed her removal so she could testify against the person she fears in Jamaica. During that time, her son turned 21, applied for an I-130, and it was granted, making her eligible to adjust status. So she presented that claim when it arose in conjunction with her request for protection against torture. And she contended that all of those facts together constituted exceptional circumstances warranting reopening. So this wasn't a claim that she was sitting on. If it had arisen at a different time, sua sponte reopening wouldn't be an issue because she complied with all the requirements to submit a timely application to reopen based on new eligibility. She had both applications presented with her motion to reopen, and the BIA just got it wrong in assessing her eligibility. And they made another error, which is the second part of our claim on the
before you move on.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask whether it really matters that the BIA made a legal error in determining her status of eligibility, because isn't the point that whether she was eligible or actually eligible isn't a rare or extraordinary circumstance that warrants reopening. And so even if they go back and fix that error, you would run into the obstacle of remand futility.
Well, Your Honor, the point is that their decision doesn't indicate that. Their decision only contains the error about her eligibility. So we would submit, Your Honor, even on that point alone, the proper approach would be to do what this court did in Pulumi and remand for consideration under the correct legal standards. But there is another issue, Your Honor. It's that Ms. Darby's claim wasn't based only on her eligibility. It was also based on the evidence of extraordinary circumstances she put forward. The extreme hardship to her four U.S. citizen children of removal, as well as her status as a cooperating witness. And the BIA completely failed to consider that evidence.
In the BIA's concluding paragraph again, when it says, and does not in itself constitute an exceptional situation, is that what you're referring to, that the legal error there, that they didn't consider the other evidence submitted?
Exactly, Your Honor. It's not like some cases where it's just not clear if they had that evidence in mind. By saying in itself, it showed that they were focusing only on their assessment of her eligibility. They did not make their exercise of discretion based on the evidence and arguments that she presented. That's both a due process violation and a legal error. And so, Your Honors, you asked us to address two points on this particular issue, the application of Torres and the persuasiveness of Haute. And the answer, Your Honors, is that Torres' holding does not apply to a claim about a failure to consider evidence. The court should instead look to decisions like Abdullah, Zhang, and Ho Q. Those cases show that a complete failure to consider the evidence is a due process violation, even
when— complete failure to consider the evidence? How does this qualify as a complete failure to consider the evidence?
Because, Your Honor, I was just discussing with Judge Restrepo, the BIA indicated that it declined to find exceptional circumstances warranting sua sponte.
But saying something doesn't rise to exceptional doesn't mean they completely failed to consider it. They adjudged it not to rise to the exceptional circumstances threshold.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the thing that they said didn't rise to that level was her eligibility in and of itself. That means that they did not look to the other evidence of extraordinary circumstances that she presented.
Okay, perhaps, I don't know if the other judges want to stay on this first point, but I do want to hear on the second point, on the cat point. And let me maybe start out somewhere a little different from where you would start out. Let's grant the other predicates of the factual. Maybe the board was mistaken here on what the procedural threshold for reopening or something else. Even if we grant those things, and you can look back to them later, I want to know, why isn't acquiescence just fatal to your claim, right? I don't see how any of this new evidence casts light on acquiescence. You have an adverse finding on acquiescence from beforehand. So even if you win on, you met the procedural standard, you only has to be a credible possibility for a remand, why isn't lack of any showing of acquiescence by the government of Jamaica and the potential gang threat fatal to a cat claim?
Yes, Your Honor. So Ms. Darby did present new evidence persuasive on that point. She showed—
How does her new evidence bear on acquiescence at all?
Sure, Your Honor. So she presented evidence that the person she fears in Jamaica and that person's associates were responsible for the death of another person involved with the same lottery.
Okay.
And there was no police interference with that.
What do you mean no? How is there evidence that the police failed to prevent one murder? How does that amount to any kind of evidence of acquiescence? A murder happens in Jamaica. You're saying that by itself tends to show acquiescence.
Your Honor, I think it's the fact that it was orchestrated without interference and without apparent repercussion of any kind.
What evidence has your client submitted that shows that there was no government interference and there were no government repercussions? Your client alleges that this person was involved. Mm-hmm. But what evidence, admissible material evidence, has your client submitted that suggests, you know, that there was no, that the police kind of stood down, stood out of the way, and did nothing to inflict repercussions afterwards?
Yeah, and Your Honor, that's because the statement from the Jamaican official cited in the article that Ms. Darby submitted mentions nothing of an investigation or suspects or anything to that effect.
A short news article, there's like a sentence. Does the sentence say this is okay by the Jamaican police or this is not a priority or anything like that?
That particular article, Your Honor, does not. However, what the BIA is required to do on a motion to reopen is to consider both the new evidence and the existing evidence together and determine whether that satisfies the prima facie threshold.
So every time there's a newspaper article that mentions a killing, coupled with some old evidence, the board has to reopen.
Well, Your Honor, not just the newspaper article mentioning a killing, but also the sworn testimony of Ms. Darby indicating that the person that she fears in Jamaica was involved in that.
He was involved, but that the fact that he's involved has nothing to do with acquiescence. She has no personal knowledge or admissible evidence that the police were involved, that there's a deal with the police are too scared, anything like that, correct?
Well, I think, Your Honor, whether or not that evidence exists is something that would have to be developed on reopening.
You have none that you can cite to me that's in the record.
What I can cite to you in the record, Your Honor, is Ms. Darby's testimony that she believes from her own experience with the lottery scheme that the police would not prevent violence against her because of their involvement in that lottery scheme and others. The immigration judge in her prior proceedings credited that police officers were involved with that particular lottery scheme. And Your Honor, that's just consistent with the broader evidence in the record that corruption and violence related to lottery schemes is a significant problem in Jamaica.
Did you tender country conditions evidence that the police avoid cracking down on such crimes?
Yes, Your Honor. That was that's some of the existing evidence in the record. We go through some of that at page 18 of our reply brief. And
all right, we'll hear from Ms. Glazer both about that and about the former IJ's finding. So go on.
So yes, Your Honor, to just wrap up on the Convention Against Torture point, the evidence regarding that violence in Jamaica, as well as the evidence that Ms. Darby fears was now aware of her cooperation, is evidence that the BIA was required to accept as true. That failure, combined with the overarching failure to apply the wrong evidentiary standard, infects every part of the BIA's Convention Against Torture ruling. And really, the essence of that problem, Your Honors, is at page 8 of the appendix. The BIA said the motion will be denied as the respondent has not shown that an exception to the 90-day filing applies. We have considered their motion, but she's not submitted evidence that she is more likely than not to be subjected to torture. That's the wrong standard. It should be the prima facie standard, a reasonable likelihood, or a realistic chance of success. The government's argument has just been that reflects the materiality standard as the instead of the prima facie standard, but that would be wrong as well, Your Honors, as we explained in our reply brief. I see that I've gone over time, so unless the court has any questions, I'll save the rest of my comments for rebuttal.
And we'll see you back shortly, Mr. Bowerman. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Glazer?
Good morning. May it please the court, Sherry Glazer appearing on behalf of the United States Attorney General. As Ms. Darby pointed out, Your Honors, there are two separate issues in this case. There's the board's refusal to invoke its sua sponte authority, which the court lacks jurisdiction to review, and the board's denial of Ms. Darby's untimely motion to reopen to reapply for cap protection. And the board acted well within its discretion in denying her motion on this basis.
Could you address counsel's issue with respect to the concluding paragraph and his argument that the analysis or lack thereof violates both due process and is a legal issue that we do have jurisdiction over?
Absolutely. I'll start with her argument that is a legal issue that this court has jurisdiction to review. What Ms. Darby is trying to do in presenting this argument, she's really manipulating what the board said and why the board declined to invoke its sua sponte authority. All the board was saying in looking at this last paragraph is that when an individual like her becomes the recipient of a family-based visa petition, when that happens, it provides a visa that's immediately available to the person. The individual doesn't have to wait for a priority date to become current, which can take quite a bit of time, and provides a path to apply for adjustment of status. All the board was saying is when that happens, after an order of removal has become administratively final, that's not rare, that's not an exceptional circumstance. And so she really is only potentially, it didn't evaluate her adjustment of status application based on any legal determination. It just said that's not rare or exceptional. And so we're not going to invoke our sua sponte authority because of that. There was absolutely no analysis whatsoever with regards to whether she is legally eligible for adjustment of status. And just sort of on top of that, while she claims that she is, she's not. As Judge Bibas points out, you know, a 212H waiver is purely discretionary too. You see that in the first line of the statute where it says that such a waiver may be granted within the Attorney General's discretion if an individual meets certain requirements. And the same is true for adjustment of status. Even if somebody does meet all the requirements, it doesn't mean the person's going to be granted it as a matter of pure discretion. And here we have an individual who was convicted of an aggravated felony. The 212H waiver does not waive that. So we still have that in the picture. So the board really, by saying she's potentially eligible and becoming potentially eligible after her final order of removal became administratively final, that's not rare or exceptional. That's all the board was saying. It was acted purely within its discretion. There's no legal determination whatsoever. And she brings up Plumy, and Plumy is a very different situation from here. In Plumy, what the board said was we decline to invoke our sua sponte authority, saying that Plumy's concern about his future health care in Albania wasn't relevant to his future persecution claim. And this court said, well, that actually could legally be relevant to his claim. So we're going to remand the case because the board relied on an incorrect legal premise. We don't have anything like that in this case, anything whatsoever. And so the government would argue that there was, in fact, no legal error. The board did not rely on any incorrect legal premise whatsoever in declining to invoke its sua sponte authority. And if I could turn to the constitutional issue, if your honors have no questions on that.
Yeah, sure, as well as the language in itself. In the concluding paragraph suggesting that the BIA did not consider the family circumstances.
Well, that's an interesting point to bring up. If you look at her motion to reopen, the harms to her family that she cites in her motion to reopen, if that's in paragraphs 16 to 17 in the record on pages 27 to 28, the evidence related to harms to her family, that was submitted with regards to the 212H waiver. That was not submitted with regards to sua sponte reopening. The sua sponte reopening argument is in paragraph 18 on page 29 of the administrative record. And what she argues is that her contributions to this country should merit sua sponte reopening, that she didn't have any convictions before or after her conviction in 2014, and that her conviction does not reflect her true character. That was the basis on which she requested sua sponte reopening. So to the extent that she's arguing that the board, you know, somehow relied on some incorrect legal premise by not addressing the harm, well, the board wasn't required to address any harm because it acted purely within its discretion. And she didn't even make that argument to ask for sua sponte reopening. And with regards to her constitutional claim, you know, her argument, it's interesting because her argument is that her due process claim is focused on the board's failure to consider the record in her motion to reopen with regards to her adjustment of status application in conjunction with the 212H waiver. But these arguments miss the mark, Your Honors, because what the central issue is in this case is the board's declining to sua sponte reopen her case. And that has to happen first before her adjustment of status application is adjudicated, and she's trying to jump the court forward to skip over that, but that is the central issue. In fact, in page 42 on her brief, she even contends that because she has this approved family-based visa petition, the quote, only barrier to her applying for relief is the need to reopen her proceedings. But that's no small thing because this court has held that the board essentially has unfettered discretion in whether to sua sponte reopen a case or not. And that's where Torres really comes into play in the analysis in Torres. And in Hernandez, this court held that when a due process claim is raised, the first thing that the court must do in any situation where a due process claim is raised, it doesn't matter what the details are of the claim, is to assess whether there's a constitutionally protected liberty interest at stake. And there is not one here. And the analysis in Torres is really telling. And the government would request that the court follow that analysis and apply it to this case. And this court reasoned that Torres had no due process liberty interest. The issue in that case was 212C relief, former 212C relief, because any grant of that relief was purely speculative because the statute doesn't set out any criteria for determining under what circumstances the former 212C relief should be granted. And the same is true with sua sponte reopening. If you look at the regulation at 8 CFR 1003.2A, you know, in fact, this court has previously found in a case the government cites, Calle de Ujes, that there's nothing in the regulation that requires the board to reopen proceedings using its sua sponte authority under any set of circumstances. There's no criteria set out in the regulation. There are no guidelines. There's nothing. It's purely within the board's discretion. And because of that, there's no constitutionally protected liberty interest at stake here. And her due process claim fails right there. It does not go any further. And while she cites Abdullahi to argue that this court should follow that case, you know, in this court in Abdullahi, which was issued before Torres and before Hernandez, did say that despite the fact that there is no constitutional right to asylum, aliens facing removal are entitled to due process. But the court didn't reconcile at all that one line in the case with the fact that, you know, asylum is discretionary, but the first step that what the court has to do is determine whether there's a constitutionally protected liberty interest, and there just isn't one here. She has no constitutionally protected liberty interest in being granted sua sponte reopening or even being considered for it. The court analyzed that second aspect in Torres too, and that analysis is also perfectly applicable to this case. You know, the court held that because discretionary relief is a matter of grace rather than a matter of right, aliens don't have a due process liberty interest in such relief. And again, it looked at 212C and found that because it uses no explicit mandatory language that could create any protectable expectation of being given such relief, sets forth no presumption in favor of relief and speaks only to discretion, that really it's just a mere hope that it will be granted. And the same is true for sua sponte reopening. And the government would argue, that because for those reasons, her due process claim fails on that basis and that basis alone.
You addressed Judge Bevis's questions to opposing counsel with respect to the acquiescence issue?
Absolutely. Judge Bevis got it right on the mark is something that I was going to bring up, that the court can deny her motion, her untimely motion to reopen, to reapply for cat protection just based on the acquiescence prong, because you know her motion to reopen in terms of acquiescence is necessary for every single cat claim, no matter what evidence somebody presents regarding if somebody is going to in fact torture them or you know whatever is presented, it has to also, somebody also always has to present evidence of acquiescence. And there is absolutely, and what somebody has to do in a motion to reopen, of course, is present new evidence, evidence that was not presented before. And there is absolutely none in her motion to reopen. All she does is rely on evidence presented in the underlying proceedings. And a motion to reopen is not an opportunity to sort of get a second bite at the apple to challenge an underlying decision when the individual, like here, did not file a petition for review within 30 days of that decision. What she says in her motion is, while I cannot contend that all members of law enforcement would fail to assist me, I still submit that many of them would turn a blind eye to my torture. And as demonstrated during my individual hearing before the immigration court, there's no doubt that law enforcement personnel participate in lottery schemes and essentially would acquiesce to any torture. So all she does is rely on the old evidence. And to the extent that she's trying to rely on this article regarding Ms. Warren's murder, there's no evidence whatsoever that a public official or any individual acting in an official capacity in Jamaica acquiesced to that torture, consented to that torture, remained willfully blind to that torture. There's no evidence whatsoever. Really, in this, on this particular aspect, her motion is styled more like a motion for reconsideration, asking for the board to look at the evidence that was presented before and reach a different conclusion, which is not what a motion to reopen is. A motion to reopen is to submit new evidence on something, and she fails to do it on the acquiescence prong, and this court can deny the petition for review with regards to her reapplication for cat protection on that basis and that basis alone.
Judge Bevis, Judge Porter, any further questions for the government?
Nothing.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Bowerman. Mr. Bowerman, you out there?
Thank you, Your Honor. I was raising my desk again.
That's all right.
So to first address the government's point about what Ms. Darby argued in her motion to reopen on the exceptional circumstances point, when it's all read together, it's very clear that the harm to her family and her status as a cooperator was very much part of her exceptional circumstances argument. Paragraph 18 that the government was referring to, that's where she first mentions the exceptional circumstances standard. In there, that includes mention of her being a loving, caring, and nurturing mother and daughter, and then her status as a cooperating witness. The respondent even took the extra step after her arrest to make amends for her crime via full cooperation with federal authorities. The next paragraph gets into more detail about some of the other bases for her argument that there were exceptional circumstances, ends with a discussion of her cooperation as well as her physically ill mother and sick United States children who continue to depend on her for guidance and support. All those arguments were presented in support of her request for sua sponte reopening, and none of them were addressed. And so, Your Honors, that, to just comment again on why that's a legal or constitutional error, the government's argument appears to be that Judge Becker's decision in Abdullah was wrong, but it wasn't. The point is that Torres and Abdullah in that line of cases deal with different kinds of claims. Torres was a failure to advise case. The petitioner there was not told during his removal proceedings and he was eligible for a 212C waiver, and so he never applied for them. The court had to decide whether that was a due process violation. It concluded that it wasn't, because that petitioner otherwise had a fair removal hearing where he received individualized considerations of the arguments he did make. Abdullah is a different kind of case. Abdullah is describing that even when there's discretionary relief at issue, the board or the IJ has to consider what evidence and arguments are presented. Zhang, Your Honors, made clear that that principle applies in the reopening context. And Hokyu also made clear that that principle applies in the sua sponte reopening context. To the extent Hoped is in conflict with those decisions, it's not persuasive. And so, Your Honors, again, the court doesn't need to resolve the debate between whether this is a constitutional error enough, because a legal error alone is sufficient to warrant reopening on that claim. And this is a legal error, the failure to consider evidence, which is basically deeming all the evidence as irrelevant to the question of exceptional circumstances, even though it very well could be. And finally, Your Honors, just one last point on the Convention Against Torture claim. The real essence of Ms. Darby's motion was that there was a materially greater risk of harm to her in Jamaica than at her last proceedings. And that's because the person she feared was now definitively aware of her cooperation and was responsible for violent acts committed in Jamaica. The point of a motion to reopen is to win a plenary hearing to present new evidence in support of a claim for relief. Ms. Darby's motion did that, satisfying the prima facie standard. The board reached a contrary conclusion only by applying the wrong threshold, ignoring evidence that she submitted and failing to accept it as true, and failing to draw reasonable inferences in her favor. The fact that the board made certain legal errors, both in her original proceedings and also in her motion to reopen, is not an excuse. The board committed the same errors in terms of their standard on relocation, as well as their focus on official policies rather than the results of those official policies when it comes to acquiescence. The evidence in the record showed that 50% of murders in Jamaica stemmed from lottery schemes and that police corruption contributed significantly to that. That's the kind of evidence that the board was required to consider and that it failed to do so. Your Honors, unless the court has further questions, we'd ask the court to reverse and with instructions to reopen as it's done in Chardar and other cases, but at the very least to remand so the board can correct the errors on both of Ms. Darby's claims.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman, and thank you very much for your efforts here, your pro bono efforts on behalf of Ms. Darby. Thank you and the folks at Hogan Lovells. It's greatly appreciated by all of us on the Third Circuit. Thank you to all counsel for your excellent briefing, all the supplemental briefing we asked you to do, all your 28J letters. Thanks again. Be well.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.